You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk Michigan history.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
Here with us again is the state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. So, Mark, what did you find for us to dig into this week?
Well, for whatever reason, I find true crime an interesting topic. It must be the researcher in me. And early in my career at the archives, I wound up assisting some different researchers and authors on the topic of the Hooper murder. And this was Senator Warren G. Hooper. He was a legislator who had turned state's witness in a corruption case, and on his way home one cold January evening was murdered. And it's been a cold case ever since January of 1945.
And is this kind of how we even got this whole weekly history segment going?
It is. A couple years ago, I met with Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark, and they were interested in this topic and wanted to do an expanded segment on it, and we talked about it and pulled out the investigation files, and everyone got really excited, and then we all went back and were really busy with our day-to-day work. And last year, I think we revived the discussion, and once we started talking about it, we realized we have so much content in the archives and at the History Center that it really was more than just one story. It was worth doing a weekly segment.
And they knew that they had a host who was a history major who cannot get enough of talking history.
I think that had something to do with it.
So who do we have to discuss the assassination of State Senator Warren Hooper, the Purple Gang's last hit?
Well, I had lots of volunteers, but joining us today are organized crime historian and author Scott Bernstein and Michigan Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta.
Well, it's great to have you both here. And I know, Scott, we've talked with you before. Rick, we can't talk about a state senator without you. So tell us, give us some background. Who was Warren Hooper?
Sure. And I have been fascinated by this cold case for many years. And so Warren Hooper was a state house member who had recently been elected to the state Senate. He was from Albion. And this was during a period of time that Michigan and the country really still carried kind of some post-prohibition morality, that corruption was sort of dealt with kind of a wink. And there was a lot of corruption in the Michigan legislature. Warren Hooper had been caught taking a bribe. I think it was some kind of a horse racing bill. And he agreed to turn state's evidence. As Mark pointed out, it was expected that his evidence would implicate a Frank McKay, who was kind of the Republican Party boss in Michigan. He was a former state treasurer, often indicted, never convicted, but was also, in many respects, also considered a great man in his day. His papers are held by the University of Michigan, and there is a building in downtown Grand Rapids that's also named after him. It's right by the Rosa Parks statue. So anyway, Hooper had agreed to participate in the to testify before the grand jury. But 4 days before that was supposed to happen, he got into his car in the parking lot of the state capitol, turned right on what is on Allegan Street, and then turned left on what is today Martin Luther King Boulevard, M99. Drove quite a few miles and got as far as Springport near Jackson on his way home to Albion when his car was forced off the road. He was shot 3 times in the head, left for dead. A cigarette that he was smoking fell down, ignited, ignited some spilled gasoline, and the car caught on fire.
Whoa.
Someone who was driving by shortly after that found that, went to a nearby farmhouse and called the police. And that was, you know, the circumstances of the Warren Hooper murder.
Scott, your area of expertise is organized crime. So here we are, last year of World War II. Give us a sense of what Michigan's organized crime scene was like then.
Well, it was flourishing. It was really coming into its own about 12 years after Prohibition ended. and was reinventing itself. The Italian mafia and the Jewish mafia, the Purple Gang, had joined forces, had melded together, and the bootlegging empire that they had both built in the 1920s and early 1930s had transitioned into an empire based on gambling, loan sharking, extortion, as well as labor racketeering, political corruption, and narcotics.
Many tentacles into society. So who from the criminal underworld do we think connected with Hooper and
why?
Well,
so even though technically this is considered a cold case, there were four Purple Gang members that were convicted of conspiracy and related to the murder of Warren Hooper.
And before we jump into that, just give us a kind of a refresher course on the Purple Gang, who they were and how feared were they?
The Purple Gang was by far the most iconic, most violent, and most successful Prohibition-era bootlegging syndicate from Detroit. Their infamy stretched way beyond the boundaries of the state of Michigan. They were a group of roughly the core Purple members, I would say, were between 30 and 50 Jewish hoodlums with, you know, several probably 100 associates. And they were led and founded by the four Bernstein brothers, who were actually cousins of mine, Abe, Ray, Joe, and Izzy. And Ray Bernstein at that time was serving a 30-year-plus prison sentence for a murder committed in 1931. But there are a lot of underworld rumors that he was actually let go on a furlough from prison on the day that Hooper was murdered and played a role as possibly the trigger man in the actual Hooper murder.
Wow. So what do we know about the connections with Hooper? And you were saying there were four members of the Purple Gang?
There were four members of the Purple Gang that were convicted of conspiracy in this case. Harry Fleischer, his brother Sammy Fleischer, young Mikey Selleck, and a guy by the name of Pete Mahoney, who actually wasn't Jewish. He was Greek, but the other three were Jewish. Harry and Sam Fleischer were core members of the Purple Gang and top lieutenants of the Bernstein brothers. Harry Fleischer was best friends with Ray Bernstein, who was the enforcer of the brothers, the man that was in charge of conducting the violence and organizing all the hitters, all the strong arms from the Purple Gang. And there was also, in the weeks leading up to Hooper's assassination, he had a public dust-up with another member of the Purple Gang by the name of Abe Buffalo Harry Rosenberg. They had run into each other at some type of nightclub around the Albion area. The Albion area was actually an outpost that a lot of ex-Purple Gang members had gone and retired to.
Interesting. And a little off the radar, maybe?
Yeah. It was about an hour and a half out of Detroit.
Not too far.
Yeah. And Rosenberg felt that Hooper had made some inappropriate comments to his girlfriend, made a pass at her, and Rosenberg had physically threatened Hooper. He was arrested in the Hooper conspiracy, but was never charged.
Rick, did people in Michigan, fellow legislators particularly, did they suspect Warren Hooper might have had his hands dirty?
Suspect. A lot of them knew it because they were just as dirty. That bribery was rampant in the legislature, and people did go on trial for it and were convicted.
I think it's important to note that this wasn't just Hooper. I believe there was about 26 legislators that were a part of this investigation.
There was a giant graft problem going on at that point.
Yeah, it was widespread.
And Frank McKay, the former treasurer, had a tie into the Purple Gang as well. Back about maybe a decade or two earlier, Frank McKay's driver and bodyguard was a guy by the name of Charles Leiter, who was the leader of the Oakland Sugar House Gang. The Oakland Sugar House Gang were the group that mentored the Bernsteins and the Purple Gang, was the Jewish mob bosses before the Purple Gang in Detroit.
When word got out that a state senator had been assassinated, Rick, what kind of reaction did that bring about in Lansing?
Well, I mean, people were shocked. Obviously, that's not a normal thing to happen. And not just Lansing, across the state. In the context of the times, when we went and looked in the archives, we not only looked at the criminal and investigation reports, we looked at the autopsy photos. We also looked at the newspaper pages from the time. And this was as the Battle of the Bulge was raging. And this was a big deal because that was, Hitler's not licked yet. And so the newspaper editors of the time were struggling with what's the bigger story? And, you know, you see them trying to stack the headlines about what's going on in the Ardennes Forest versus, you know, what happened, you know, right here in Michigan with this shocking, shocking crime. But part of the result of the assassination was the case that the prosecutor, Kim Sigler, was trying to put together against Frank McKay fell apart. And so, you know, some legislators went on trial for corruption, yes, and, you know, that there were some people convicted of conspiracy to commit murder. But what makes the Warren Hooper murder officially unsolved is that, you know, we never found out who actually pulled the trigger and built a trail back to who ordered it.
There was an informer within the Purple Gang group that allowed prosecutors to eventually bring charges, and that was Sammy Abramowitz, who was involved in the conspiracy. And Sammy Abramowitz actually also fingered Ray Bernstein as being involved in it. As I said, I think it's interesting that as much corruption as was going on in the legislature and in political circles around here, there was a lot of corruption in the prison system in Michigan, to the point where Ray Bernstein, who had been in prison at that point for 15 years, could possibly get out, you know, get out from prison walls and go and conduct a high-profile murder like that.
Wow. So give us your hypothesis, Scott Bernstein, on what happened with Senator Hooper. As we say, it's not really been solved.
We know there was a $500. He admitted to taking a $500 bribe to vote against a horse race bill that would have put regulations on possible cheating and horse race fixing. We know that the Detroit Italian Mafia, who at that time the remnants of the Purple Gang had disbanded in the 1930s, and those that wanted to continue in the rackets went underneath the banner of the Italian Mafia. The Italian Mafia, from the late 1940s onward, controlled all horse racing in the state of Michigan as well as Ohio and West Virginia. And it was a very, very valuable commodity of theirs, and they protected it, you know, through various ends.
So any kind of legislation aimed at clipping their wings was not well received.
I believe this was, you know, an order that was brought down most likely from the higher-ups in the Italian Mafia, the Zerilli-Tocco crime family, if you will, and was a job, a responsibility that was tasked with the Purple Gang because of the Purple Gang's relationship to Frank McKay. Mm. And the Fleischer brothers, young Mikey Selleck, who was the Fleischer brothers' protege, and Pete Mahoney were known to have met at a Purple Gang hangout in Detroit called O'Larry's. It was a bar on Dexter Avenue, and I believe that the Hooper murder was planned from that bar. Sammy Abramowitz was recruited by the Fleischer brothers to take part in it, and I do believe from my research and from talking to people that were connected to those people that Ray Bernstein was, you know, got out of prison for that day and was the trigger man in this high profile assassination.
You know, we hear these kinds of stories and you think of, you know, you're throwing out all of this activity in the 30s and the 40s. Is organized crime just as active now as in the last century, but more off the radar? Where are we now?
I wouldn't say it's just as active. Okay. I mean, it was considerably more widespread in the mid 20th century, but right now in Detroit, I would still say it's very active and it's thriving in the shadows per the reputation of the Tocco, Zerilli-Tocco crime family has been for 100 years. They're a group that, you know, lives by the adage, make money, not headlines.
Mm.
And they know how to stay under the radar. They know how to stay out of prison. And they know how to vertically integrate, if you will, turn dirty money into clean money by really, you know, taking the boardroom and the corporate world by storm. These are guys that aren't your typical knuckle-dragging gangsters. These are efficient businessmen as they are efficient killers.
Rick, you think of where we are today. Do you ever have a feeling, could something like this happen again in Michigan?
Not like that. The times are just very different. That this was a seminal point in Michigan history when, you know, as I said earlier, that corruption was sort of viewed with a nod and a wink. And this was a wake-up call for the public that that corruption and corruption that existed in politics and state government in Michigan was a serious, serious problem, and it changed how how people viewed these sorts of things. That said, that every now and then, something does still pop up. Remember the Ed Gysi bribery trial?
I would bring the story forward from what Scott was saying and note that in 1989, they reopened the Michigan State Police reopened the investigation because there were some weapons found at the state prison in Jackson that they wanted to test for ballistics, thinking maybe that they were the weapons used.
And was Ray Bernstein at Jackson?
Yes, Ray Bernstein was at Jackson.
So I think that's why they made that connection, and they did ballistics tests.
Let me just also add, as an aside, the Purple Gang members that were incarcerated in the various Michigan state prisons, just to demonstrate how they had the run of the prisons. These were guys that I know specifically in we're talking about 1945 here, and the Detroit Tigers were in the World Series in 1945. And there are stories that I believe are true where the Purple Gang members got out for the World Series.
Yeah.
They were allowed to leave the prison and take state vehicles down to Detroit to go watch the Tigers play the Chicago Cubs at Tiger Stadium. And as long as they were, back by bed count, it was no harm, no foul. So it just shows you what a free reign they had within the penal system in Michigan.
Scott, is there any truth to the story that the Hooper killers may have used a deputy warden's car when they?
There's actually a picture of them as trustees in that vehicle in the archives. Yeah, and so the ballistics tests were inconclusive, and I don't know. It's still an open case. The state police did a few years ago. We worked with them on transferring materials from their evidence vault, and one of the items that they transferred to the Michigan History Center was the fedora that Hooper was wearing when he was murdered.
Mm. Fascinating.
You can still
stuff.
See it in the museum. Yes. You put it out from time to time.
Yes,
there are bullet holes in it.
There we go. Well, we want to thank you, Mark Harvey, State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, pointing out the anniversary of the assassination of State Senator Warren Hooper, which happened this week in 1945, and then enlightening us and bringing us lots of good organized crime dish is organized crime historian Scott Bernstein and our Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. You guys were great. Thank you so much. This was fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.